This is Fresh Air. Our sex, most of us grow up believing, is a gift of nature. Just about the first words out of the doctor's mouth in the birthing room are, "It's a boy," or "It's a girl." My guest, medical historian Thomas Lecoeur, says it's not so clear what makes a boy and what makes a girl. Lecoeur is the author of a new book. It's called Making Sex, Body and Gender from the Greeks to Freud. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Thomas Lecoeur, what is sex?
Well, what is sex? That's the problem of the book, isn't it? I mean, most of us think sex is just sort of is a biological given. And in some ways, I don't want to deny that that they're boys and girls. I suppose the problem that interests me historically is whether boys and girls are opposite sexes or versions of each other or what. So I don't know if there is an answer to sort of what is sex in a historical sense. I mean, I think that's it varies in time and circumstance.
You start out with the Greek physician Galen in the 2nd century A.D.,
right.
And you quote a passage from Galen in which he explains that there really is only one sex, not two. I'm going to quote this passage from Galen, and he says, "Think first of the man's external genitalia, turned in and extending inward between the rectum and the bladder. If this should happen, the scrotum would necessarily take the place of the uterus, with the testes lying outside, next to it on either side." I mean, this is the father of modern medical, well, this is the father of medical anatomy, right. So-called.
He's the most important doctor for a couple of thousand years, this man.
So tell us what it is that that Galen, and I suppose his followers, all the way up to a couple hundred years ago, what did they see in the body?
Well, by the Renaissance, we can actually see what they saw because they drew it, and what they saw was the male organs, the penis and the scrotum, being a kind of extruded version of the vagina. And then they say, well, why is it excluded? Why do men have this penis outside while women have a vagina inside? The answer is, in their view, that men are more perfect. And by more perfect, they mean having more vital heat, that being higher on the scale of being. So what they say
the hotter
is,
you are, the better
hotter
you are.
You are, the better you are, right? But hot is a kind of metaphysical idea. It's not that you can put your hand on someone's head and say, aha, they're hot, they must be a man. So then they say, you're perfect, and so the organ gets pushed out. So women have it inside, and men have it outside. And then by the Renaissance, when you would think, now that they do lots of dissections, I mean, they dissect hundreds of bodies, literally, men as well as women, you'd think, well, now that you open it up and you look, you'd see that this was a patently, to us, a kind of silly idea. But in fact, much to my surprise, the opposite took place. The more they looked, the more vividly this thing, which was only a kind of metaphor for Galen, was actualized in drawings. So, I mean, I found there must be 20 anatomy books, pictures of vaginas that look exactly like penises. In fact, if I were to flash them before you, I suspect if you didn't look carefully, you'd find it hard to distinguish which organ was being shown.
And women had testicles in this vision.
Women had testicles, and they also, that's the word they used. It's a masculine testicle and feminine testicle. In fact, that was the word. Well into the 18th century, and even 19th century medical books, when they refer to ovaries, still say what used to be called the feminine testicle. So it was a long time before we got this sort of distinction between ovaries and testicles, which now seems so stable and so firm. So women have testicles, and women have a penis, and women have a foreskin, which is the external parts of them, of their genitalia, the vulva, they thought it was the foreskin. So every part could be mapped, they thought, and in fact, that's how they drew it.
So what follows from this perception all the way up until pretty close to 1800? What follows from this conception of the female body as having these submerged male organs?
Well, I think probably lots of things follow. Just at a very practical level, just at a clinical level, since the bodies were versions of each other, the bodies sexually thought to work the same way, so that no one before the late 18th century ever questioned that women had orgasms, which is actually one of the sort of interesting things that got me going on the book. Men and women.
Wait. Yeah. Right here. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some question about whether women enjoy pleasure in mm-hmm. sex, and you also point out that for most of the last couple of thousand years, it was assumed that you couldn't conceive children unless there was orgasm and pleasure.
Absolutely. That's because, you see, if they're versions of each other, if they essentially work the same way, why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't the sexual and reproductive things work the same way? So, you see, it seems to me there's no reason not to believe that women don't have orgasm just like men.
So men were men then obliged to be sure that the woman had a good time?
Well, people have often asked me, do you really believe this? And in that sense, I said, I can't tell. I mean, we don't have the Kinsey reports from the 16th century, so we don't know what really happened. But certainly every clinical guide, popular and the learned tradition and books by women and books by men all say that if you want to have kids, which is, after all, the point of having sex that was generally held, women had to have orgasms. And if you weren't having kids, the men should attend to that. Are you sure you're touching her privities delicately? Are you tickling her breasts? Are you doing all these things that are going to turn her on? It says to the male readers, and to the women it says, be sure your husband does it. If he doesn't do it, you might have to do it yourself. And it gives advice on doing it. So I can't tell whether they really did it, but certainly everyone believed they ought to be doing it.
My guest is Thomas Lecker. He is a medical historian at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the author of a new book, Making Sex, Body and Gender, From the Greeks to Freud. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Thomas Lecker. He is a medical historian. We're talking about sex. We're talking about gender. We're talking about whether sex defines gender or gender defines sex. What is it that invented the woman's body as a separate body?
Well, that's a real interesting question. And at first I thought, remember, I got into this by trying to see what happened to this idea of women having orgasms just like men. So at first I thought, obviously science told us differently. You know, we discovered that by and large women don't have to have orgasms to conceive. And we discovered that the ovaries are different than the testicles, and that the tissue of the vagina is different than the penis. And so that's the answer. We know more. They were ignorant. We're not. So I thought that was my work. That was the hypothesis I went in with. Well, then it turns out that that people started talking as if they were two sexes and drawing pictures as if they were two sexes before any of that was known. So that the fact that orgasm wasn't necessary for conception as a kind of scientific fact wasn't established until the 20th century. I mean, people had no idea when the menstrual cycle women conceived until the late 1920s. And whether it was connected to orgasm or not was very much in doubt for a variety of reasons we can go into if you want.
Well, apparently even in advice columns in the newspapers today, you still sort of have this kind of remnant of the notion that without orgasm, a woman doesn't have to worry about getting pregnant.
Absolutely. You still find it in Dear Abby and so forth. Every couple of years, there's a question it writes in, can I have a baby if I don't have an orgasm? And every time Dear Abby says, yes, be careful. Oh, sure. It's still very much part of the popular imagination.
So, all right, that's Dear Abby, but let's rewind the history tape here.
But I'm saying doctors didn't know this either until the 1920s. I mean, doctors giving their patients all sorts of strange advice well into our century. So if the change happened in, let's say, pick up 1800, more or less, then we can't explain it by scientific discoveries of the early 20th century. So we have to explain it by something else.
And that something else is what?
Well, that something else is a lot of things, it turns out. But I think that something else has to do with a variety of political changes and philosophical changes. The philosophical change, I think, is that the real philosophical point of the scientific revolution of the late 17th and early 18th century is that there really is only one plane of reality. That's the physical plane. If we want to understand difference, we don't want to talk in terms of more or less perfect, which of course makes the humans part of a hierarchy that goes into the heavens. You know, we're less perfect than angels and more perfect than dogs. So we don't want to explain things that way. We want to explain things just in terms of matter, in terms of biology. So if an 18th century person wants to explain why men and women are different for some particular purpose, like a political purpose, they can't allude to perfection. They have to allude to bodies. So that focuses attention on bodies. All right, that's the first point. Second point is that women in the 18th century and also men to some extent are beginning to make the claim that there's no real reason why women can't do many of the same public things that men can do. French revolutionaries made that claim. Others made the claim. Well, if you want to argue against that, for example, you have to say, well, that's actually not true. You see, women's bodies are different. We're just built differently for different purposes. So you could have the model where saying, all right, women are built, they're made, they're different than men, and they're made for the home and for something private. And men, on the other hand, are built for something public. So if you want to argue against women's public roles, you make that kind of argument based on the nature of their bodies. You see? And so there are political purposes for making the new argument, and you can't make it anymore on the basis of perfection. You have to make it in terms of physical, sort of anthropological evidence. That focuses on bodies, and that makes people who sort of provide the support for this kind of political talk begin to represent bodies as opposites rather than as hierarchically organized.
Well, let's go back to orgasm then. If bodies are different, if men and women are different, and if men believe themselves to be having orgasms, do they believe that women any longer derive pleasure from orgasms?
Well, some men obviously still do, and some doctors still do. But you can make the argument, just take it for example, and women make this argument too for other political purposes, that look, yes, men are driven by sex, and they have these powerful orgasms. Women, on the other hand, aren't driven by sex. They don't have this intense raging feelings or this pang of orgasm, and that has a lot of advantages. For example, it means that women can be more, in general, sort of more self-sacrificing. They don't care for their own pleasure, neither in the family or in a sexual context.
Now, it's men who are making these arguments.
Men are making these arguments, but it's real interesting that in some cases women, for other political purposes, are making the arguments too. For example, by the late 19th century, some of lesbian feminists are making that kind of argument, that in order just to kind of argue against what they take to be the constant pressure from men for sexual gratification. And even in the early 19th century, some women are making that argument because they want to take a political stand on their particular capacity for empathy and for not being driven by the baser emotions. So a lot of men make the argument, probably more men than women, but the arguments can be made by anyone. See, what I'm really arguing in this whole book is that you can construe sexual difference kind of any way you like, or one sex or two sex, depending on your political purposes. And those political purposes vary in time and in place. So I try to give a bunch of examples over two centuries, but I don't hit every one. You see, so men and women, feminists and anti-feminists, can argue just about any way.
What about androgyny? Androgyny in men's fashion designs, in women's fashion designs, it certainly has gone well beyond Madonna.
Right.
And we see now that the new Paris men's designs are suggesting soft shoulders, baggier fits.
Right.
What do we make of this sort of commercial campaign for the androgynous body, or at least the decoration of the androgynous body in clothing?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know as much about it as I do. I'm just a mere historian, but I think that I think it's playing with this idea of not so much androgyny, but sexual fluidity. In other words, the body, and sort of the clothed body, doesn't have to bespeak opposition, but can bespeak a scale, can bespeak all sorts of play with that anatomy. And so in some sense, what I've said is that organs, and you put it most radically, that organs are maybe, in lots of contexts, another form of clothes. Just as we can play with clothes, we can play with how we imagine organs. And people in the past have played with how one imagines organs.
What do you mean there? That the sexual function is completely constructed, and that the anatomy we were born with really has not much of anything to do with...
Well, I don't know whether people would say not much of anything to do. It certainly has to do with some things like having babies. So in that sense, I'm not an anti-biology person. I do think bodies exist and they're important, and to hold otherwise is to be is kind of silly. But on the other hand, it does seem real clear that one doesn't have to get one sexual gratification from the orifice that society has proclaimed that one ought to get one's gratification from. And one doesn't have to dress or otherwise perform publicly in a way that sort of reinforces or represents these conventional social roles. So I suppose in some ways it is no accident, as they say, that you know, I wrote this book across the bay from San Francisco, where you only have to walk down the Polk Street or the Castro to see a kind of sometimes a kind of carnival of in some sense making sex and making gender.
Thomas LeCoeur is my guest. He is the author of a new book, Making Sex, Body and Gender, From the Greeks to Freud. This is Fresh Air.